It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In his summary of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, Attorney General William Barr said that the probe found no evidence of collusion between President Donald Trump's campaign and Russia, but stopped short of concluding that President Trump didn't obstruct justice. Congresswoman Gwen Moore joins us to talk about what's next.
We're glad it's over. It's 100% the way it should have been. I wish it could have gone a lot sooner, a lot quicker.
The president's glad it's over, wishes it could have gone a lot quicker, but now the fight is over whether or not we get to see the full report and when. How do you think Congress should proceed following the release of Attorney General Barr's summary of the Mueller report? Do you think the summary suffices, or do you want to know more about why the probe stopped short of concluding that President Trump didn't obstruct justice? What questions do you still have about what's in the report? Do you think that releasing it in full will put an end to the political fights over it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is our email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. United States Congresswoman Gwen Moore is a Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th District that covers the Milwaukee area. Moore has served in Congress since she was first elected in 2004. Congresswoman Moore, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. After Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report was delivered, you said in a statement that, quote, the public deserves to know what his report reveals. Let the games begin. Can you elaborate on that for us? What are you gearing up to do?
Well, you know, I made that statement before we even heard William Barr's report. So when I said, let the games begin, that was indicative of the fact that I'm not at all surprised by the conclusions. Certainly not surprised by the conclusion that William Barr made that there was no obstruction of justice. William Barr, as you recall, interviewed for this job by spreading widely his 19-page memo indicating that the president should not be investigated, that as executive over the Department of Justice, that he could not obstruct justice by firing James Comey, which was the issue at that time. And so when I said let the games begin, it was because I recognized that we were about to have the, you know, underplay for the overplay, as they say. Secondly, go on.
Well, go ahead. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay. Secondly, it's not surprising in hindsight that Mueller was reluctant to make to rule on obstruction of justice because what we don't know, and one of the reasons that we need to see the underlying report, is this declination due to Manafort not cooperating? That's really significant to me because we've seen the president sort of dangle pardons out there for Paul Manafort. All of the lies that have occurred. Is his inability to actually prove conspiracy, so-called collusion, is the special prosecutor's inability to do that based on the fact that the obstruction occurred so well? And that's what we need to determine, a couple of things we need to determine.
House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler is reportedly looking to set a date for Attorney General William Barr to testify about the report. What are Democrats hoping to achieve with this?
Well, the committees of jurisdiction do what they do. Jerry Nadler is the distinguished chair of the Judiciary Committee. Some of us were never relying on the Mueller report in order to do our work. As the House of Representatives. But it's interesting that you should mention that because Mueller, having punted the question of whether or not there was obstruction of justice should have gone to the House of Representatives. I mean, we are the body that determines whether or not there are impeachable offenses, not the Attorney General of the United States.
United States Congresswoman Gwen Moore is a Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th District, covering the Milwaukee area. She has served in Congress since first being elected in 2004. We're talking about the aftermath of Attorney General Barr's release of his 4-page summary of the Mueller investigation. Congresswoman Moore, if the report is, in fact, released in full, what specifically are you looking for?
Well, thank you for asking that. I mean, I think any American want to know what sort of plan we can put together, what kind of protocols we can put together to prevent not only Russia but other countries from attacking our democracy. I'm curious, for example, about the meeting with Paul Manafort and Kilimick, where he passed sensitive polling data on to the Russians. I'm curious as to why that was not seen as a crime. I am curious, again, whether there were declinations in Paul Mueller's document where he says that there are people who I could have indicted, but I didn't. I'm curious about the money, the movement of money in the campaign. Surely the special prosecutor must have noted the indebtedness that both Paul Manafort, Donald Trump, Donald Jr. had to Russian oligarchs and the activity that emanated through Deutsche Bank. And perhaps some of those were sent out to other prosecutors. But I think I want to follow the money trail as well.
Is there a political risk here for Democrats of pushing too hard and possibly turning voters off?
There absolutely is a political risk. There always was a political risk. We've been at risk all of this time. And we have like 589 days before the next November election, but who's counting? And I think that our charge has got to be a couple of things. To first of all, lean into the things that helped us win. I mean, the healthcare system in this country is a hot mess, and the president totally reneged on his promise to give us better healthcare. They've gone out of their way to destroy a market-driven solution through the Affordable Care Act. They continue to undermine it. And meanwhile, not just millions of people with no health insurance don't have it, but they've destabilized it for the other 80% of us who receive it through our employer-sponsored insurance. We have got to lean in toward trying to do some sort of infrastructure project. And my fear is the president is going to just spend the next 590 days being a peacock and whining and complaining about the report instead of working with us to do something about infrastructure, up to and including doing something about our woeful infrastructure with our water pipes in Milwaukee and in places like Flint. We've got to lean into these things, saving Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
And Congressman, woman, we're out of time. Thank you, Congresswoman Moore, for joining us this morning on The Morning Show. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, carpe diem.
Up next, we talk with a financial expert about who payday loans help and who they hurt. I'm John Munson, and for Kate Archer Kent, it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Payday loans are typically used by people with lower incomes and are usually marketed by lenders as a remedy for unexpected financial emergencies. The industry has been accused of taking advantage of the poor and economically disadvantaged The Trump administration has delayed implementation of Obama-era rules seeking to curb some of the worst practices, leaving it up to the states to regulate the industry. But is that a good idea? Some people see this move as a disaster for the poor. Some see it as strengthening states' rights. But now we have internet lenders. And how do the states regulate those? Do you have questions about payday loans? Have you used them? Tell us about your experience. Did it serve as a quick resource to help you get out of a jam, or did the high interest rates hurt your ability to actually pay back the loan? What questions do you have about the differences between payday loans and loans from a regular bank or credit union? Did you turn to a payday lender when a traditional financial institution like a bank or credit union was inaccessible to you? Do you think that we need a better way to provide short-term financing to people who need it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join our conversation about payday loans. You can also reach us on email, ideas@wpr.org. My guest in this segment is Cassie Chandler. She's a certified public accountant and business advisor for Jacksonville State University in Alabama. She teaches and researches in the areas of business and accounting and has studied the impact of regulations on the payday loan industry. Cassie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, John.
Well, thanks a lot for being here. Before we dive into the impact of regulating the payday lending industry, give us an explainer. How does payday lending generally work?
Absolutely. So the typical customer looking for a payday loan is someone who is short on cash at the moment and needs just a little bit of cash quickly to meet financial obligations. And typically, with these types of consumers, it's going to be your day-to-day expenses. You know, they need enough cash to quickly pay their utility bill or their rent. Maybe their car has broken down and they need a little extra cash to get that fixed in order to have a means of living to get back and forth to work. So typically, these consumers do not have access to capital through the form of a traditional bank. So they might not have a good credit score. They might not have any credit at all. And so with a payday loan, the consumer can go into a payday lending shop or, you know, somewhere like that, and they can apply for a very short-term loan, typically about 2 weeks. So the average, you know, pay cycle and the term of the loan will be until their next payday. On average, these loans are somewhere in about the $375 range. And so that doesn't seem like a lot. Seems like enough just to get the consumer by, and then when they get paid next, then they'll just repay the loan, and that was just something that would tide them over until they, you know, were back on their feet. However, what happens is that in order to, you know, borrow these funds, what the lender does is charge approximately $15 as a fee per $100 lended to the borrower. And so most borrowers, you know, they may not be financially literate to the point of understanding that, you know, this is a 15% interest rate, and that's what they see. But that's a 15% interest rate for a term of 2 weeks, which computes annually to an APR of over 400%. And so this is where typically the consumers might fall into a cycle of debt. When it comes around to their pay period, they can't repay that initial loan, and then they will have to continue renewing it for additional fees and interest.
And let's face it, the average bank doesn't like to mess around with loans of a term of 2 weeks, do they? I mean, do banks usually even have programs like this? You don't walk into the bank and say, hey, I need $500 for 2 weeks.
Right. That's typically not the case. And, you know, just walking into a traditional bank, if you'd like to get a loan, you have to sit down, go through a credit check, you know, prove your income, show your expenses, everything like that. And the typical consumer looking for a payday loan, you know, something for, you know, very short term, they're not going to have the information that the bank would like to see. You know, they will not have that favorable information to be able to be granted the loan anyway.
And so these are high risk, what would be considered high risk borrowers who are borrowing unsecured money. I mean, there's no collateral, although there is a separate business of title credit companies that will loan you money based on having a clean title for your car. But for payday lenders, these are unsecured loans, short term to high risk individuals. So it's quite a bit different than the financial instruments from a bank or a credit union. So what is the expectation here then? I mean, how do these people get off this treadmill once they get on it?
It's very complicated, and that's why it's considered to be predatory by some people. You know, this may have its place if you are, you know, truly able to repay the loan. You just need that, you know, couple hundred dollars to get you by to your next payday, then that's great, and I could see where that might work. But as a business model, it almost seems like the payday lending industry kind of milks what they can from these, you know, very desperate borrowers who then cannot repay the loan, you know, that they had initiated for a term of 2 weeks. And then it continues, you know, on a cycle. And so from what I've seen, there are very common instances where a borrower will, you know, take out a $200 two-week loan. And because they were already in a tight spot at that time, once they get paid, you know, they've still got to pay their rent again. They've got to pay their utilities. And so they can't pay back that lump sum of the $200 that they had previously borrowed. So it's easier for them to just simply renew it. And by renewing it, you know, they'll just push out the term for another 2 weeks. And all that the consumer has to do is just pay the fee again. And so still, they're still carrying that principal balance of the initial loan that they had requested.
Which is still generating that enormous amount of annual interest while it's sitting there. So, I guess that's one of the things we're talking about here today with Cassie Chandler, a business advisor for Jacksonville State University in Alabama. She's getting us up to speed on the payday lending industry in lieu of the CFPB changing regulations for lenders. Have you ever used payday loans? Tell us about your experience. Was it a quick resource getting you out of a jam, or did the high interest rates hurt your ability to pay back the loan? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ideally, Cassie, you'd pay back the loan rather quickly to avoid the high interest rate. Well, but even more than that, ideally, you'd have $200 in savings if that's what you needed. Is part of the problem here that people just aren't making enough money to have a savings account with enough money in it so that when the car breaks down or the rent's due and your income is a little short, you've got something to fall back on?
I think that might be part of the problem. Also, too, our citizens really need some enhanced financial literacy. And so in our area, we have banks who have different types of financial literacy classes and things like that, just teaching a basic budget. And so really, instead of preying on these types of consumers, like the payday loan seems to be, I think it would be more beneficial if we could just have more educational classes, you know, teaching our citizens, this is how you prepare a budget, and this is how you can save $200 in a rather short amount of time so that when you need it, you don't have to go out and participate in this type of lending behavior.
Well, you use the term predatory as one description of how payday lenders are framed in terms of, you know, how they are perceived by the public. Is it because of high interest rates, or is it some other characteristics of these loans that cause us to use the term predatory? And are these loans just set up so people will fail?
It almost seems like they are set up for failure, but I'll give you a little more information, too. So first of all, most states do have a maximum loan amount, so it's not necessarily, you know, that the lenders are giving out more than, you know, a reasonable amount. And so some of those maximum loans amounts for several states that do have payday lending, you're looking at between $500 and $1,000 maximum loan. So, you know, this is not a huge dollar value of the loan. So what can be considered predatory then would be the interest rates, Because like I mentioned, just for a typical two-week payday loan, you're looking at about a 400% annual interest rate, and that's across the board for most states. And some of them are even upwards of that, up to 1,000% APR, which just seems astronomical. So I feel like if the consumers understood this better, then maybe they wouldn't be, you know, as reliant on the payday lending industry. But another argument, though, is when you're that desperate for cash, you need to do what you need to do to take care of your expenses. And at least payday lending is a legal business versus turning to something else. And so then just real quickly, the other part of it that's predatory is the cycle that you get into of not being able to repay.
And we will talk about that cycle after the news as we continue our conversation about payday lending, specifically how the government does and doesn't regulate lenders, and get your story about your borrowing experience. 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. From NPR. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Payday loans are typically used by people with lower incomes and are usually marketed by lenders as a remedy for unexpected financial emergencies. Stopgap financing, if you will. The industry has been accused of taking advantage of the poor and economically disadvantaged, though, and the Trump administration has delayed implementation of Obama-era rules seeking to curb some of the worst practices and leaving it up to states to regulate the industry. Some see this move as a disaster for the poor. Some see it as strengthening states' rights. But what about internet lenders? Can the states regulate those? Have you used a payday loan before? What was your experience like? Do you have questions about the differences between payday loans and loans from a bank or credit union? Did you turn to a payday lender when a traditional financial institution turned you down? And do you work in the payday lending industry? Share your perspective with us. How do you see this service impacting customers and the community? And does the federal government need to do more to strictly regulate payday lending? Or do you think it's an overregulated sector of the economy and that regulations hurt those who need those services? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cassie Chandler is a certified public accountant and business advisor for Jacksonville State University in Alabama. She has studied the impact of regulations on the payday loan industry. Cassie, just before the news, we were talking about the cycle of payday loans and how people get into trouble and they just keep rolling these loans over, just paying the interest charges, or as a loan shark would talk about it, paying the VIG and not paying the principal back and ending up in a longer term debt on what was supposed to be a 2 week a loan. Let's talk a little bit more about that cycle, and then we have a full phone bank of people who want to talk about this issue.
Great. So basically what happens, like I had mentioned previously, was, you know, in initiating these typically two-week term loans, there's already, you know, some sort of financial need there. You know, there's a reason that someone needs cash quickly, and this is a way for them to be able to have access to that. However, in another 2 weeks when they get paid, there's also still most likely going to be another financial need at that time, which will be, you know, just to pay day-to-day expenses, to pay rent, to pay utilities. And so at that point, it just becomes easier and more effective for the borrower at that point in time to just continue to renew the loan. And so the problem there is that it almost becomes like another, you know, installment loan or a car note or something that they already have. They're just continuing to make that payment each month, but without actually paying down any of the principal. They're basically just continuing to renew the same balance over and over, and it becomes a cycle of debt, they call it.
Let's take a call. Greg is with us in La Crosse this morning. Greg, good morning.
Good morning. Cassie, I'm a little suspicious of, the capitalists that are getting into these businesses. If they're dealing with high-risk debtors, why would someone want to get into a business like this where, you know, unless they're using it as a tax shelter, if they're having to get into collections often to get money back, have you looked into that at all, or are they able to just milk money back from people to make it worthwhile to enter into a business like this?
Right. From that business standpoint, this industry actually makes a lot of money off of the fees. So, not necessarily being able to collect all of the principal back, you know, if the consumer does default on the loan. Just to give you an example, so in a typical year, there are 12 million people who borrow from payday lenders. And so that amounts to about $50 billion worth of loans. So on that, the payday industry actually makes about somewhere between $7 and $9 billion off just the interest and fees from generating these loans. So you can see, you know, they're still definitely generating money. And so I know that there can be some instances where, you know, people feel as though they're an advocate for, you know, those who can't necessarily make their, you know, their payments each month and things like that. So they truly do feel like they are helping the consumers. But at the same time, you know, if you loan money to someone who, you know, you have suspicions can't repay it, there seems to be a little bit of a problem there. But like I said, through the fees and interest that they generate, you know, the industry definitely generates some income off of that.
Greg, thanks so much for your call. We've mentioned regulations that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau placed on the payday lending industry during the Obama administration. Can you briefly tell us what those regulations were and what they were supposed to do?
Sure. Okay, so the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or we call it the CFPB, so it was formed in 2010 basically as President Obama was, you know, working on some Wall Street reform and things like that after, you know, the 2008 crisis that we had with the housing market. And so basically what the CFPB was formed to do is to basically help protect the consumers who are looking for payday loans and other similar loans like that. So basically the CFPB needs to oversee the federal financial laws that protect specifically these consumers. And so some of the regulations that had been discussed in 2017 and were now supposed to go into compliance in August of this year, 2019. So a couple of those things related to, one, making sure that the consumer actually has the ability to repay the loan. So, you know, right now you can go into an establishment and explain to them, you know, you need X amount of dollars and you can pay them back on your next payday. And, you know, without any hesitation, for the most part, typically they can make that loan for you, especially because it's typically those smaller loans. However, it doesn't matter the dollar value. If the consumer cannot afford to repay the loan in the 2 weeks, then a lot of people are saying that's an unfair practice. So that was one of the things that the CFPB addressed. And then the other was continuing to carry these loans, roll them over. There needed to be a cooling off period before a consumer could continue to just carry over this loan forward indefinitely.
And what happened with those regulations? Have they in fact been in force, or what has the Trump administration done with these rules?
Well, it seems like the CFPB right now is trying to take a complete 180 turnaround, in that now with the Trump administration under a new director for the CFPB, basically they're trying to just do away with the ability to pay rule. And so this can be seen as you know, helping those lower income consumers who do need access to loans, you know, making it a little bit more of a fair market. And so, you know, their perspective is that payday loans aren't the problem. You know, it's the individual needs to assess if they have the ability to repay the loan on their own. And so, you know, whether payday lending should be regulated or unregulated. That's the true issue here, not necessarily whether payday lending should exist.
You've studied different regulations on payday lending back in 2016. What did you find out about the effectiveness of regulations and include state regulations in that?
Sure. Okay. So basically, before the CFPB was brought into play, each state regulated all of the laws regarding payday lending anyway. And that is still the case. You know, some states do not even allow payday lending at all. And then the states that do allow payday lending, they each have their own individual regulations regarding the loan amount, the maximum loan term, so the number of days, and then the annual percentage rate. And so there are some states who basically have no regulation in the fact that, the loan could be made for whatever amount, and then, you know, maybe some regulation on the term or the interest rate, and then vice versa for other states. So really, it's just very confusing state to state. And the argument can be made that, you know, this is good for states' rights, that states will, you know, continue to be able to have their own regulations. But at the same time, it can be very very confusing for consumers. And so with those regulations, I'm not sure. It would be interesting to see what some of the effects have been. And then also, you know, if this does go into full effect as of August 19th, it will be very interesting to see, you know, the consumers' reactions and, you know, not having that access to capital, where will they turn? So the next few months will be really interesting to see, you know, if the CFPB does actually reverse those regulations.
Let's get a quick call in here from Kathy in East Troy before we move on here. Kathy, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Every time, at least any time that I have heard people discussing payday loans, they always seem to classify people that use those loans as ignorant financially and basically put them down. If they only knew, these poor benighted people would not be using those loans. I am not ignorant financially. I have had times where I have come up short in the past regarding in a very emergency situation where I would not have been able to get a quick loan from a bank. So I have used payday loans. I have never gotten in trouble with them. I have paid the loan back. But the constant hammering of how financially ignorant people that use that program are.
Kathy, we get it. We have to go to a break, and we will have our guest respond to your comment in just a moment. Cassie Chandler is a certified public accountant and has studied the payday loan industry. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Payday loans, good thing, bad thing? Predatory lending or a much-needed community service? We're talking about payday loans with Cassie Chandler, certified public accountant and a business advisor at Jacksonville State University in Alabama. She has studied the impact of regulations on the payday loan industry, and she's here with us to talk about payday loans. We want you to be with us, too. What has your experience been? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cassie, we had a caller, Kathy, just a moment ago, who said, hey, the characterization of the typical borrower as being ignorant of finance is off base, and that she's used payday loans and paid them back, and she's completely aware, or was at the time that she took out the loans, completely aware of all the terms and so forth. Would you say that Kathy's situation is typical?
Actually, John, I don't think so. I'm so glad that, you know, there is a consumer base that the payday loan industry works for, you know, and things go as planned. And Kathy, I'm so glad that you had access to that capital when you needed it, because like you said, you might not have had anywhere else to turn if not for a payday loan. And so I think that is the, you know, the optimal, the ideal situation with these types of loans. However, unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the typical case. And so the cycle of debt, like I've previously talked about, that seems to be more the typical response to obtaining a payday loan and then not being able to repay it. And so I don't think it's necessarily always that a consumer is ignorant, you know, of how finances work and things like that. Unfortunately, I just feel like the payday loan industry sometimes can prey on those who are vulnerable. You know, when you need cash immediately, no matter what else is going on in your life, you are immediately vulnerable at that moment. And then on top of that, you don't even necessarily have to have a job in order to get a payday loan. You could also be on disability or retirement, something like that. And so that also makes you a little bit more vulnerable inherently as a consumer. And so it's those types of instances where we feel like, or others feel like also, that payday loans can be somewhat predatory toward their consumers.
Let's take a quick call for Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I also believe that payday loan companies are needed in the community service. I think they should be putting a cap on the interest rate. State should like put a cap on interest rates, and it should go by your income, because without a car you can't get a job. Okay, you might have to take out a loan. Okay, and these are, like I said, it's a very needed service.
All right, Mary Kay, thanks for that. Cassie, what about maximum interest rates as a regulation of payday lending?
I think that's an excellent point that she made. And also, like I said, since it is state regulated, typically the states, you know, can determine what a maximum APR should be or could be, you know, cap it that way. But unfortunately, even in these instances, the APR is still so just astronomically high. But there have been states working toward making a cap, for example, 36%. And so although that's still higher than, you know, any traditional rates, it's still acceptable enough for a consumer to be able to realistically repay the amount without having to continue to renew. So, yes. And, you know, like I had said, it's not necessarily about being, you know, for or against payday lending itself. It's just for or against regulation. And so, like she mentioned, that would be a regulation at the state level, maybe capping an APR.
What's one more thing as we close here? What's one more thing that we could do to make payday loans work better for consumers?
It's great that there is access to credit because, like our previous caller said, you know, without a payday loan, someone might have to turn somewhere else, potentially to some, you know, illegal activity. The argument has been made at least payday lending is a legal business. And so also, you know, someone might not have anywhere else to turn. So if there could be just a little bit more maybe some financial counseling up front,
okay,
to better explain. You know, even though there's truth in lending, some people might still not quite understand what that exactly means.
Cassie, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Cassie Chandler is a certified public accountant and a business advisor for Jacksonville State University in Alabama, and she studied the impact of regulations on the payday loan industry. Now, a dispute over the insurance carried by a Canadian energy firm will be heard by the state's highest court this week. The fight stems from one county's requirement that Enbridge Energy obtain special pollution insurance as part of the company's plans to triple the amount of oil being sent through a pipeline running across Wisconsin.
A creek runs along the edge of Keith Riopel's property. He and his wife built their home in the small village of Marshall in Dane County about 8 years ago.
Kind of like a little slice of heaven for us.
Here he can trade the bustle of Madison for the sounds of sandhill cranes and wood ducks. But Riopel says he didn't know when they moved in that an oil pipeline was running through the land nearby. Then energy firm Enbridge expanded the pipeline. Now Riopelle, who heads Dane County's climate change efforts, and others are part of a lawsuit to keep a county permit requirement that Enbridge obtain insurance to cover cleanup costs of any potential spill.
Heaven forbid if there was ever a spill here, but if that does happen, you know, we want the company to be responsible, and we don't want to be the next Kalamazoo River situation here in our backyard.
Oil from an Enbridge pipeline spilled into Michigan's Kalamazoo River in 2010. The cleanup recovered more than 1 million gallons of oil and cost the company $1.2 billion. Dave Galt is Dane County Assistant Corporation Counsel.
Our zoning committee had some concern that Enbridge provide some assurance that they had the financial responsibility to completely remediate any potential catastrophic spill.
The county and landowners say that threat is growing as Enbridge expands the pipeline's capacity up to 1.2 million barrels per day. With scientists sounding the alarm on climate change, county officials also fear a transition to renewable energy could make a company that transports fossil fuels less financially stable. But in 2015, lawmakers slipped a last-minute measure into the budget to block Dane County's insurance requirement. It said if a pipeline operator already carries a policy that covers sudden and accidental pollution, counties couldn't require more. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said then that Republicans adopted the proposal because Dane County was holding up the project.
They're going to do it in a safe way, but we want to make sure that we have an opportunity for those jobs and the opportunity to get that project done.
Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith says the company believes the county's insurance requirements violate the law, and there's no guarantee they could get the kind of insurance the county wants.
But outside of that, they're really unnecessary. We do have the appropriate insurance, and we do have the resources and financial withstanding to respond in the rare event of a pipeline incident.
Enbridge challenged the additional insurance requirements in county court and won, but the county and landowners appealed. An appeals court panel ruled in their favor. Now the case will be heard by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But the county and landowners worry Enbridge's policy doesn't cover everything. Insurance consultant David Dibdahl evaluated the company's coverage as part of Dane County's permitting process. He says the company's general liability policy limits coverage to damage or pollution that's reported within a certain time frame. And he says Enbridge only provided a summary of its insurance.
Which I took in faith because Enbridge is a big company and they hire professional risk managers and competent insurance brokers. If they represent they have coverage, they probably do as represented.
Dibdahl says the company claimed the insurance contained trade secrets, but he thinks that shouldn't prevent them from presenting the documents in court, and landowner Keith Riopelle agrees.
If they have insurance that they think is adequate, you'd think the easiest way to convince people of that would be to, you know, take out the insurance policy and walk into the courts and say, here it is, look at it.
Enbridge argues the law doesn't require them to provide the policies. The company hopes the Supreme Court will allow their permit to stand without the insurance requirements. The county and Riopelle hope they'll be able to use whatever means available to protect landowners from the risks of a potential spill. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you, Danielle. To check out past coverage on this issue, you can go to WPR.org. Just ahead on the Ideas Network, we'll take a look back at the history of women in the space program. And we'll also talk about the possibility of going back to the moon. One of the big questions, how will we get there? I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.